Sitting with John, after all. But Philip hadn't invited her to dinner, just lunch.
"Can I come too?" Alex teased her. "And if this guy is interested in you, don't tell John when he comes home on Sunday night just because you feel guilty. You have nothing to feel guilty about. As far as you know, it's just a business lunch."
And whatever it was, Jane was looking forward to it, even if she was nervous.
"Maybe I should cancel," Jane said as they left the restaurant, still uneasy about the lunch. "Maybe my boss wouldn't like me having lunch with a guy from Christie's." "If you cancel, I'll kill you. Go. He sounds nice, and it's none of your boss's business who you have lunch with. It'll be good for your ego."
John certainly wasn't, Alex thought, but didn't say. He had been ignoring Jane most of the time for months and took her for granted, and that wasn't new. Alex didn't like the way he spoke to Jane at times, although she never seemed to notice. Alex thought he was arrogant and dismissive and full of himself, and Jane seemed to think that was okay.
"You're not doing anything wrong," she reminded Jane again. "Have some fun for a change."
"Yeah, maybe,"
Jane said, unconvinced, but she was going. She liked him and was flattered by the invitation, whatever his motivation.
"He probably just wants to talk about the sale," she said to reassure herself.
"Exactly,"
Alex said, trying to encourage her so she wouldn't feel so guilty.
"Just remember, it's a business lunch. Then it won't seem scary."
"He wouldn't ask me otherwise,"
Jane said, sure of it now. He probably just wanted to discuss some aspect of the sale.
"Of course not. You're ugly, stupid, and boring. He probably feels sorry for you,"
her friend said, teasing her, and they both laughed as they got to the movie and bought tickets and then popcorn and Cokes. It was a nice way to spend a Saturday afternoon, and now that she'd talked to Alex about it, Jane felt better. Alex didn't tell her that she was beginning to suspect John was sleeping with Kara, from what Jane had said. He was spending way too much time with her and the group, at the library and coming home at 4 in the morning or later, and weekends in the Hamptons without Jane. She didn't want to panic Jane about him, but she was happy Jane was going to lunch with Philip. It was exactly what she needed. A little male attention in her life from someone new, even if it was just business. And they both forgot about it as they watched the movie. Alex couldn't wait to hear how lunch turned out on Monday, and made Jane promise to call her that afternoon. While Alex and Jane watched the movie, Valerie went to visit her sister. Winnie's cold had turned into a sinus infection and bronchitis, and she was miserable. Valerie had promised to buy some groceries for her, and turned up with chicken soup from a nearby deli and a bag full of fresh fruit and oranges she was going to squeeze for her. Winnie lived on 79th Street and Park Avenue, which was a long way from Valerie's cozy apartment in Soho. Winnie had lived in the same apartment for 30 years. It was somber-looking, filled with dark English antiques, and Valerie always wanted to pull the curtains back to let in the sunlight when she went there, but the tomb-like atmosphere suited her sister. She was feeling terrible, and Valerie went to the kitchen to squeeze the oranges for her and handed her a glass of fresh juice a few minutes later. Winnie had a maid during the week, but no help on the weekends, and she was completely unable to fend for herself. Valerie put the groceries in the fridge and told her to heat the soup in the microwave later, as Winnie looked at her mournfully. The doctor had given her antibiotics, but she said they weren't working.
"Maybe it's pneumonia. I should get an X-ray next week,"
Winnie said nervously.
"I think you'll be fine," Valerie said calmly, and handed her some magazines she brought her to distract her.
"I had a flu shot before Christmas and a pneumonia shot. I don't think they worked,"
Winnie said, looking panicked. She was going to be 79 on her next birthday, nearly 80, she often said, which frightened her. She was terrified of dying and went to the doctor all the time. She drank the orange juice, and then took a swig of Maalox in case it gave her heartburn. She took a dozen different vitamins every day, and still got sick. Valerie tried not to make fun of her or tease her about it. Winnie took her health very seriously, although her daughter Penny said she was strong as an ox and would outlive them all.
"So what have you been up to this week?" Valerie asked her, trying to get her mind off her health. "Nothing. I've been sick,"
she said, as they sat down in the little sitting room where Winnie watched TV alone at night.
She didn't go out as often as her sister, had few friends, and no activities that interested her, except playing bridge twice a week. She was good at it. Valerie thought it was incredibly boring, but didn't say so. At least it gave her something to do that involved other people.
"We missed you at the museum party on Thursday night. We had a good table. I took Philip."
Valerie knew that if she had gone with Winnie, her sister would have insisted on leaving right after dinner. She hated staying out late, and said she needed her sleep.
"Have you talked to Penny?"
"She never calls me,"
Winnie said sourly. Her relationship with her daughter had been strained for years, and she complained that her grandchildren never came to visit. They loved visiting Valerie and exploring her studio, but she never told her older sister, nor the fact that she and Penny had lunch occasionally, so she could vent about her mother. Penny's complaints about her mother were similar to what Valerie had felt about her own. Winnie and their mother were cold women, who always saw the glasses half empty and never half full.
"Philip is working on an estate at the moment," Valerie said to distract her.
It was hard coming up with subjects Winnie wouldn't say something unpleasant about. She was constantly annoyed at something. Taxes, or the fees charged by the bank, her losses in the stock market, her rude grandchildren, a neighbor she was feuding with. There was always something, but Philip's estate sale seemed like a neutral subject.
"The surrogate's court had him appraise the contents of an abandoned safe deposit box, and they found jewelry in it worth millions. The woman it belonged to died intestate, and no heirs have turned up, so they're selling it all at Christie's for the benefit of the state."
"As high as our taxes are, the state doesn't need millions in jewelry,"
Winnie said sourly.
"If she had all that jewelry, why didn't she leave a will?"
It seemed stupid to her.
"Who knows? Maybe she had no one to leave it to. Or maybe she was sick or confused. She was American and had married an Italian count during the war. It's sort of a romantic story and a coincidence. Her maiden name was Pearson, like ours. And even more so, her first name was Marguerite. Philip asked if we might be related to her, if she was a cousin or something. But I don't know of anyone in our family who lived in Italy or married an Italian count. She died 7 months ago at 91. Actually, Valerie said, suddenly looking pensive, that's the same age our sister would have been. That's even weirder.
And as she said it, she felt as though puzzle pieces were slipping into place, or cogs in a machine.
"I've never thought of it, but what if Marguerite didn't die when we were kids, but moved to Italy and married an Italian count? It would have been just like our parents to disapprove of it, and pretend she had died. Wouldn't that be amazing?"
Valerie said thoughtfully, turning the idea around in her mind, as her older sister looked at her, horrified by what she was saying.
"Are you insane? Mother never got over her death. She mourned Marguerite, our sister who died for the rest of her life. She couldn't even bear to see a photograph of her. She was so heartbroken, and Daddy forbade us to talk about her."
Valerie remembered it, too.
"She might have been just as heartbroken over her marrying an Italian count. Can you see our parents ever accepting that?"
And Valerie had thought it odd that when their mother died, they had not found a single picture of their older sister among their mother's things. Valerie had always assumed that photographs of her had been put away, but if they were, they had never found them. They had no photographs of their older sister, even as a child, although Winnie claimed she remembered what she looked like, which Valerie seriously doubted. And the idea she had just come up with was fascinating to her, but Winnie looked at her in strong disapproval.
"Are you trying to convince me or yourself that you're an heir to that jewelry worth millions that Christie's is selling? Are you that desperate for money? I thought you still had most of Lawrence's insurance."
Although it certainly wasn't worth as much as the jewelry that was going to be auctioned. Valerie looked at her as though that was ridiculous, and not simply rude.
"Of course not. I'm not interested in the money, but the story is intriguing. What was Marguerite's middle name?"
"I'm not sure,"
Winnie said fiercely.
"Mother and Daddy never talked about it."
"Was it Wallace? I think that's the name Philip mentioned when he asked me."
"I've never heard that name, and I think you're getting senile,"
Winnie said angrily. She suddenly reminded Valerie more than ever of their mother. There had always been subjects they weren't allowed to ask about or mention,
and their older sister was one of them. They'd been told all the years that they were growing up that their older sister's death at 19 was a tragedy that their mother had never recovered from, and they weren't allowed to bring it up or anything relating to her. Eventually, it was as though she had never existed, and she'd been so much older than they were that they never knew her. It was as though Marguerite had been their real child, and Winnie and Valerie were the interlopers, unwelcome visitors in their parents' house, and Valerie even more so than Winnie, since she had been so different from them all her life, just as she was from Winnie now.
How dare you come up with a theory like that, to besmirch our sister's memory and dishonor our parents? They were kind, good, loving people, no matter what you choose to say about them now.
I don't know who your parents were, Valerie said coolly, looking straight at her. My parents had ice in their veins, and stone hearts, Dad and particularly our mother, and you know it. She liked you better because you were more like her. You even look like her, but she couldn't stand me, and you know that too. Dad even apologized to me for it before he died, and said she'd had a hard time accepting me because she was so much older when I was born, which is a poor excuse for the way she treated me. I was 40 when Philip was born, and it was the happiest day of my life, and still is.
Mother was older, and she went through a difficult change of life. She was probably suffering from some form of depression,
Winnie said, always willing to make excuses for her, which Valerie had stopped doing years before. Their mother was a mean woman, and had been a terrible mother, to Valerie certainly, and she was only slightly warmer to Winnie, which Winnie had decided was acceptable. But it wasn't, by any means, to her younger sister. In fact, although she had been cold to Winnie, which was her style, she had been downright cruel to Valerie at times, in ways she wasn't to Winnie.
She was depressed for my entire life?
Valerie said cynically.
I don't think so, although it's a good story, and I think there are some very strange coincidences here. The age of the woman who left the jewelry, the fact that our sister was a forbidden subject, and this woman who became a countess went to Italy around the same time our sister left and died a year later. And what was she doing in Italy during the war? They never told us, and we were never allowed to ask. Don't you want to know more? What if she'd been alive for all these years, and only died recently? How many Marguerite Pearsons of that age can there be in the world? What if she's related to us, Winnie? Don't you want to know?
Valerie suddenly couldn't tear her mind away from the possibilities, and she wanted answers, but all she could do was guess.
You want the jewelry and the money,
Winnie accused her, and Valerie stood up, disgusted with her.
If you really think that, you truly don't know me, but you know me better than that. You're just afraid to find out what they may have hidden from us. Why? What good are all those taboo subjects now? Who are you protecting, them or yourself? Are you so frightened that you don't want to know the truth? We know the truth. Our sister died of influenza at 19 while traveling in Italy, and it broke our mother's heart. What more do you need to know? There was a war on then, Winnie. What was she doing there, visiting Mussolini?
It had always seemed odd to Valerie in later years that their sister had been in Italy during the war, with no explanation for why she'd been there. But there was no one left to ask.
I don't know, and I don't care. She's been dead for 73 years. Why would you even think of digging all that up now, and dishonoring our parents? The only reason I can think of is that you want to claim you're the heir to the jewelry being sold at Christie's. Did Philip put you up to this? Is he in on it, too?
Winnie said accusingly.
Of course not. I told him we weren't related to her. But suddenly I'm wondering if that's true. Maybe we are. Maybe she isn't even a cousin. Maybe that was our sister who married the Italian count. We may never know the truth, but at least at our age, we're allowed to ask. And who's going to tell you the truth? Mother and father are gone. We have no photographs of her. No one else would know. And I don't want to know. We have a sister who, we were told, with absolute certainty by our parents, died in 1943. That's good enough for me. And if you're not after this money or jewelry that doesn't belong to us, just let it go.
It's not about money or jewels. It's about the truth. We have a right to that. We always did. Our parents cheated us out of love and affection and kindness while we were growing up, and maybe they cheated us out of our sister as well. If she were alive, we could have gone to find her and met her when we grew up. Maybe she was alive for all that time, and if so, I want to know that now. You're always demonizing our parents, and they don't deserve that. Let their memories rest in peace. What did they ever do to you to deserve this kind of disrespect? They can't defend themselves now,
Winnie said in a fury.
They didn't love me, Winnie, and you know it. I'm not even sure they loved you or were capable of it. But I know they didn't love me. I felt it every day of my life until I left and married Lawrence.
She said it quietly and with enormous strength. It was the core truth of her life.
What you're saying is a lie,
Winnie said, standing to face her and shaking with rage.
Get out of my house!
She shouted at her younger sister, and what Valerie could see in her eyes was fear, raw terror, of a ghost she couldn't face, and everything she didn't want to know. Valerie nodded, picked up her coat and bag, and walked out without a word. But the voice of truth she was seeking couldn't be silenced any more. Chapter 8 Philip spent the weekend on his boat, as he always did. Valerie had plans on Sunday night. She had said she was dining with friends, and he knew she had the occasional suitor, men her age, who admired her, usually widowers. But she was never interested in them romantically and treated them as friends. Valerie had made it clear to him several times that the only man she had ever loved or would love was his father, which was easy to believe, given how happy they'd been together. Valerie went out with friends, but not on dates. Philip wanted to do some work at home, but he stopped in to see her on the way to his apartment. He called first, and she was back from dinner. She made tea for them after he declined a drink, and she seemed subdued to him, and he asked her if anything was wrong.
No, no, I'm fine, she said quickly, but he wasn't convinced. What did you do this weekend?
He was always concerned about her, and something in her eyes seemed sad.
I went to see Winnie yesterday.
How was that? He knew how difficult and aggravating his aunt could be. He was his cousin Penny's confidant, too. His mother smiled with a small, wintry look before she answered.
She was Winnie. She's sick, and she wasn't in a great mood.
And she'd been in an even worse one when Valerie suggested that their mother had never loved them, and might have lied to them about Marguerite. You're a saint, Philip said with feeling. He avoided his aunt whenever he could. He had given up trying to have a real or decent relationship with her years before. They talked about an exhibit of South American artists Valerie had been to during the weekend that she had enjoyed, and another show was coming to the Met that she wanted to see. And then she doubled back to what was on her mind. She didn't want to say too much about it to him, and tried to sound casual when she brought it up.
I was thinking about your big jewelry sale again, the one of the contents of the abandoned safe deposit box. It probably sounds ridiculous, but I'd love to see the photographs you have of Marguerite. In fact, all of them. You said you were going to use a few in the catalog, but I'd really like to see them. You never know how it might inspire me. Maybe I'll get a painting out of it. The story is haunting, and the fact that she wound up so alone from what must have been a very glamorous life when she was young and married to the Count.
She tried to make it sound artistic and historical rather than personal, and he looked pensive when she asked.
I've only got a few of them myself, and I was going to return them to the clerk of the court at lunch tomorrow. I'm sure she's not supposed to pass around those photographs. The surrogate's court is responsible for them, and any papers, correspondence, or documents. But the clerk I've been dealing with is a very nice woman. She's a law student, and she might be willing to make copies for you, if I ask her. I'll ask when I return the ones I have tomorrow.
The way he had said it instantly caught Valerie's attention, although Philip thought he had sounded very neutral about it. She knew him better.
Do I sense some kind of interest there, other than returning photographs to the court?
He was stunned by what she said. It was always as though she could look into his soul. It had seemed almost eerie to him when he was a boy. She always knew what he was up to, as though she could read his mind. Of course not. She's been very helpful. I've only seen her twice at the bank, he said, brushing his mother off, but she had an odd feeling that she was onto something.
Sometimes that's enough.
She smiled directly at him, not wanting to tell him her own suspicions about her parents lying about Marguerite.
Anyway, see what she'd be willing to let you have. I'd like to see all the photographs if I could.
She was very definite about it, which made him curious. He knew her well, too. Is there some deeper reason? He asked candidly.
No, I just have strong feelings about this woman, of sympathy and compassion. She must have been so lonely, and it's amazing that she held on to the jewelry for all this time. It must have meant a great deal to her, or the man who gave it to her. It seems like a powerful love story somehow.
I hadn't thought about it that way. The jewels are just very beautiful and worth a great deal of money, Philip said honestly.
I'll bet that's not why she hung on to them, or she would have sold them long ago, particularly if she needed money.
Her circumstances sounded so sad when Philip had told his mother about her, and now, like him and Jane, Valerie was haunted by her. That much made sense to him. Are you at all intrigued by the coincidence of your maiden names? It wasn't a loaded question, just a direct one.
Not really, although I suppose that could be some kind of bond.
She looked vague as she said it, and then got up to take their teacups into the kitchen and turn the conversation to something else. She hoped that her request would be fruitful, and the young clerk he had mentioned would give him copies of the photographs. She didn't dare bring it up again or alert him to what she wanted to know. She wasn't even certain what she was looking for, since she had never seen a picture of her oldest sister, but she hoped there might be some kind of clue, if they were related somehow. You never knew. And she had felt compelled to ask. She had thought of nothing else since the day before, and Winnie's vehement denial of the possibilities she had proposed to her only made her want to know more. She wanted to actually see Marguerite de Saint-Pignelli now, in the only way she could, in the contents of the safe deposit box. The next morning, before meeting Jane for lunch, Philip sent an email to Cartier in Paris to inquire about their archives. He knew that they saved working drawings of all the pieces they made, particularly the ones for important people or unusually beautiful orders that had been placed. Cartier prided themselves on their archives, and he explained that Christie's would be selling several of their more important pieces from the 1940s and 1950s, which had belonged to the Countess de Saint-Pignelli. He gave them Umberto's name as well, and said he believed that they had lived in Naples and Rome between 1942 and 1965, from when Marguerite had arrived in Europe until her husband died. He doubted that any of the pieces had been commissioned after that, and he said he wanted to know everything about them, who they had been commissioned by, when, and for what reason. The original prices would have been interesting to know, too, although they would bear no relation to their current value. And the origin of the stones would be helpful to them, too. Anything that Cartier could provide would enhance the catalog and create further interest in the sale. He asked them to email any available information and said he would also be in Paris in late March for an important jewelry sale being run out of Christie's Paris office. He said he would be happy to meet with the director of their archives at that time. He sent a similar email to Van Cleef and Arpels and had enough time to return a few calls before Jane arrived. He was finishing his last call to make an appointment for an appraisal just as Jane was walking through the impressive lobby with three-story ceilings and a huge mural and getting in the elevator to meet him in the jewelry department on the sixth floor. She was a little awestruck when she arrived. She had expected it to be an ordinary office building, and Rockefeller Center was anything but that. It had been home to Christie's for 18 years. A young woman in a simple black suit and a string of pearls called Philip in his office and told him that there was a Miss Willoughby waiting for him in the reception area. Philip smiled and left his desk instantly. He came out to meet her, happy to see her, and escorted her back to his office, which was handsome and had an enormous desk.
"So this is where you organize all those important jewelry sales," Jane said with a soft smile. It made it all seem very real suddenly being there.
"Some of them. I don't make the decisions here. I just implement them. And we have offices all over the world." He told her about the upcoming Paris sale then. Some of Marie Antoinette's jewelry was going to be auctioned off by a family that had owned it since the Revolution.
They had offered to sell it to a museum, but they wouldn't pay enough, so it was going to a public auction, along with other important pieces, many of them historical. Paris had seemed like the right venue for the sale. There were often equally important sales in London, and some in Geneva, but New York was the venue for most of their important sales. He explained to Jane that whatever the location, there would be people bidding on the phone and in the room from around the world. "It's very exciting, especially when the bidding gets hot, and there are several active bidders determined to get the same item. That's when the price goes sky high. It all depends on how badly someone wants it. Jewelry is very emotional, but the really big prices are in art. That's not just about passion, it's about business and investment. Art is perceived as a better investment than jewels, but things can get pretty heated at our jewelry auctions, too. The Elizabeth Taylor sale in 2011 went right through the roof. It was the highest total for any collection we've ever achieved, before or after. There was a lot of mystique to the woman and her jewels. There are only a handful of people who create that kind of excitement and demand, like the Duchess of Windsor. You could sell one of her handkerchiefs and make a fortune." He smiled at Jane as he explained. "I had just started here and was still in the art department during the Elizabeth Taylor sale. We sold a number of her paintings, too. She had some fabulous art, most of it given to her by Richard Burton. It was a tumultuous relationship, but he was very generous with her. She was the kind of woman who inspired that. Even the sale of her clothing brought in a huge amount, as though women felt that if they could wear some item of her wardrobe, they could be her, or inspire the same kind of love and passion she did. It's all part of the magic of an auction, which is why we want to make Marguerite de Sampignelli's sale as personal as we can. The provenance and who owned it previously is very important to a lot of buyers." Jane was riveted by what he had said. He made auction sound almost magical. It was all new to her. "I'd love to come to the sale," she said softly as he led her out of his office. "I told you, you can sit in the room if you like, or with me at the phones, and hear what's happening with the bidding. It can get pretty crazy, especially at these big prices." They were still working on the estimates they were going to put on the pieces, but the final results were always hard to predict. It all depended on how much a buyer wanted a piece, or better yet, two or several buyers, determined to get an item at any price to create a bidding war. The seller and the auction house always hoped for that, and the bidder who ultimately prevailed, no matter what the cost. Philip would love Marguerite's pieces to draw that kind of interest, and the more they could put in the catalog to add to the excitement, mystique, and hype, the better it would be for the sale. And even though the sale was only to benefit the state of New York, Philip's innate professionalism made him want the results to be exceptional. The pieces they were selling deserved it. He explained all of it to Jane as they went through the lobby, left the building, and walked 2 blocks to the restaurant. It was a tiny place, but cozy, pretty, and warm. He had asked for a quiet table, and Jane settled back against the banquette and smiled at him. Everything he had told her had been interesting, and it helped to put her at ease with him. This was obviously not a date, and Alex had been right. She had nothing to feel guilty about. This was all about the upcoming sale that they were both involved in. She felt foolish now for having been worried about it. "So how did you spend your weekend?" he asked. "I went to the movies with a friend," Jane said benignly, "and did some review work for the bar exam, and worked on my final paper." "That doesn't sound like fun," he said, looking sympathetic. She seemed like a serious person, and he admired her for what she was doing, and had done very well with the Pignelli estate. "What kind of law do you want to go into?" he asked with interest. "Family law, child advocacy. While parents are battling in a divorce, sometimes people forget what's best for the child. All these tug-of-war arrangements, joint custody, where a child switches homes on alternate nights or every few days or flip-flops week by week so both parents feel they're winning, can screw the kids over in the end. I want to start there, in a family law firm, and see where it takes me after that. Foster care, working with indigent kids, there are a lot of possibilities." "So you're not interested in estate or tax law?" he asked, smiling at her. "Hell no," she said, and laughed.
I can't think of anything worse. This case has been really interesting, but everything else I did at the surrogate's court has been tedious and depressing. After she ordered cheese soufflé and he ordered confit de canard, Jane asked, "What about you? What did you do this weekend?"
"I spent the weekend with my mistress," he said matter-of-factly,
and Jane looked startled. "That's nice," she said, trying to be open-minded about it. But it confirmed that this was definitely not a date. So much for Alex and what she'd thought. And he looked innocent as he smiled across the table at Jane.
"She's a 30-foot classic 40-year-old sailboat I keep on Long Island. She eats up all my money and takes all my energy and concentration, and I spend every weekend taking care of her. I think that's pretty much what a mistress does, and being with her is pure joy. I can't stay away from her, much to the dismay of every woman I've ever gone out with. Her name is Sally. Maybe you'd like to meet her sometime, when the weather gets warmer. It's a little chilly on Long Island Sound right now." Not that he cared. He went out on her no matter what the weather, winter or summer. Jane could see the love in his eyes, and she laughed. "A boat is stiff competition for most women, more so than any mistress. My father keeps a sailboat on Lake Michigan. My mother says it's the only rival she's ever had. I used to sail with him every weekend when I was a kid." She didn't tell him that her father's boat was 3 times the size of his. His boat is the love of his life. "Sweet Sally is mine," Philip confessed proudly, without apology or shame. He thought it best to be honest right from the first.
"I'd love to see her sometime," Jane said easily. "I went to sailing camp for 3 summers in Maine when I was a kid. I was kind of a tomboy since I have no siblings, and my father taught me to sail. Then I discovered high heels and makeup in high school and kind of lost interest in sailing. But I still go out on the boat with him sometimes when I go home. My mother hates it, so he always wants me to sail with him."
"Sally has broken up most of my relationships," he said with a slightly sheepish look. "How has your parents' marriage survived, or are they divorced?"
He was learning about her, and he liked what he'd heard so far. "No, they're together. I think they came to a compromise years ago. My father doesn't ask her to sail with him anymore, and she doesn't expect him to go skiing with her. My mom was a champion ski racer in college and won a bronze in the Olympics, downhill racing. She still loves it, and he hates skiing, so they each do what they like to do. And they expected me to learn both, but I'm not in my mom's league on the slopes. She skis the French Alps and goes helicopter skiing in Canada every year."
"My mother is an artist, and she's pretty good, very good, in fact. I can't draw a straight line. My father was an art history professor, so I take after him. I've always been passionate about art and boats." He smiled.
"I feel that way about the law," she said as they ate their lunch, "and championing the cause of the underdog. And I'm passionate about protecting kids. I worked for a legal coalition for inner-city kids in Detroit during the summers when I was in college, and I was a paralegal at the ACLU before I went to law school. I finally decided to stop horsing around and get my degree. It's been a rugged 3 years. The surrogate's court has been pretty uneventful compared to all that, until now. All you get to do is dispose of the belongings of people who had no one to leave them to, never thought about it, or didn't care, and settle disputes between greedy relatives who weren't interested in the person when they were alive. It's not very happy work. I couldn't do this for the rest of my life. I barely made it through the last 3 months, and I have kind of an unfriendly boss. I guess you get cynical and sour dealing with this kind of thing all the time, and I think she has an unhappy life. She's never been married, and she lives with her sick mom. I think she's a very lonely woman. She's been nicer to me lately, but we got off to a bad start." Harriet seemed to have more confidence in her since the Pignelli estate, but Jane could never imagine their being friends, or even having lunch together at work. Harriet kept her distance at all times and remained aloof. Jane had the feeling that Harriet had no life other than work and caring for her mother, at night and on the weekends.
"As I told you, I've been unhappy, assigned to the jewelry department," Philip said. "All I wanted was to get back to art. But I have to admit, this sale has made it more interesting for me. Something about it touched me."
So did meeting her, which he didn't say. He didn't want to sound stupid or soft or scare her off, but Jane was very real and genuine, which appealed to him, almost as much as Marguerite's estate and the woman who had owned the jewels, and he liked talking to her. They chatted easily during lunch, exchanging experiences in their respective fields and personal views on a variety of subjects, including relationships, travel, and sports. He told her how much he had enjoyed his trips to Hong Kong for work, and that now, as superficial as he had found jewelry in the beginning, and the people who bought and sold it, he had become intrigued by all things jade. It represented infinite mystery to him, and he said it was an area of expertise that few people understood and did well. And then he remembered his mother's request. "This probably sounds silly, but my mother has become totally enthralled by and wrapped up in what I've told her about Marguerite and the sale. Maybe she feels some tie to her because they have the same maiden name, although they're not related. But as an artist, she has a very creative mind and is always interested in the hidden aspects of things. She has an amazing imagination and a kind heart. She asked if she could see copies of all the photographs in the safe deposit box, just to get a feeling for her. She thought it might inspire a painting, not necessarily of Marguerite herself, but maybe someone like her. It's hard to understand how artists work sometimes. She wanted to see the photographs, not just of her, but also of Umberto, and even the ones of them at parties, all the pictures that we looked at. It didn't sound outlandish to Jane, and she thought his mother sounded like an interesting woman. "Do you think she'd want to see the pictures of the little girl?" They still didn't know who she was, or what relation she'd been to Marguerite, if any, and they didn't know her name. "Why not? It's part of the mystery surrounding her," he said simply, and Jane nodded, thinking about how to fulfill his request. "Do you want me to return the ones I have, and then you can send me the complete file, or should I get these copied and give them back to you another time?"
"Why don't I take these now? I have to ask my boss about giving you copies," she said, pensive for a minute. "Would it be all right if I told her you wanted to see them all again for the sale, for a last comprehensive look? I think if I say it's for your mother, she would balk. But if they're for you, the sale or the catalog, she won't hesitate, and then I can send you the entire file, and you can copy them for your mom. I don't see anything wrong with that." He nodded and agreed with her, pleased. "I'll ask her when I go back to the office. I have all of them on my computer. I just want to ask her permission to send them to you, so I don't get in trouble later. She's been giving me a free hand with it, but I've been doing it according to the rules."
"If you send them to me in an email, I can print them up for my mother. She's not a computer person. It would probably take a year for her to open the files." They both smiled, and she said her own mother wasn't good with computers either, as he gave her back the photographs he had. Computer skills were not of their parents' generation, particularly his mother, who was considerably older than her parents, and old enough to be her grandmother, or even his, since she had been so much older when he was born. But he said that she was younger in spirit and had more energy than anyone he knew of his own age. "She has a sister who's only 4 years older and acts like she's 100. It's hard to believe she's almost the same age as my mom. They seem generations apart. I guess it's all in your outlook on life and how connected you stay to the world. I don't think my Aunt Winnie ever was. My mother says their parents were like that, too, stuffy and old-fashioned and rigidly stuck in their ways and antiquated points of view. My mother is entirely different, fortunately. I never knew my grandparents, but I take her word for it, if they were anything like my aunt. My maternal grandmother died before I was born, and my grandfather when I was a year old." And then he startled Jane by saying that he'd like to see her again sometime, maybe for dinner. He said he'd had a great time at lunch with her. And she said that she had, too.
"Dinner might not be such a good idea," she said regretfully, looking at him across the table and wishing that she could. "I've been living with someone for the past few years. We've hit kind of a rough patch lately. He's getting his MBA in June. It's all he thinks about. I hardly see him, and our time together is pretty much a disaster at the moment." She didn't tell him that the relationship was, too, which would have seemed disloyal to John. She didn't want to give Philip the impression that she was more available than she really was. She was still living with John.
I have lots of free time on my hands, since he's either at the library or with his study group, but I figure things will get normal again when we graduate. I don't think it would really be fair for me to go to dinner with someone else right now. Philip admired her for her honesty and the fact that she didn't want to sneak around behind John's back, which was clearly not her style. She was smart, attractive, and straightforward. She seemed to have it all, and he felt like it was just his luck that she was involved with someone else. The good ones always were. "Maybe a movie sometime," he said hopefully. "Just as friends. Or you could come out on the boat some weekend in the warm weather while he's studying." "I'd love that," she said, her eyes shining. She was grateful that he understood, and a little disappointed, too, that she wasn't free, but she was glad she'd been honest with him. Now he knew, and it didn't seem to discourage him from wanting to see her away from work. Maybe they could wind up friends. She'd had a wonderful time with him at lunch. They left the restaurant, and he walked her to the subway. She promised to ask Harriet about sending him copies of all the photographs, and he knew she would. She was a woman of her word, and had done everything so far that she'd promised to do. "Thank you again for lunch," she said warmly as he smiled down at her as they stood next to the subway stairs. "Let's do a movie soon, and I want to introduce you to Sally as soon as she's presentable. I'm going to paint her hall in a few weeks." There was always some part of her that he was working on, just like Jane's father with his boat. She had spent a lot of weekends scraping, sanding, varnishing, and painting to help him when she was young. She knew all about men with boats, and smiled at what he said. She went down the subway stairs then, and disappeared, as Philip walked back to work, thinking about her, and looking forward to seeing her again. He was disappointed that she had a boyfriend, but there was always the possibility, however remote, that things wouldn't work out with them, even after graduation in June. He was willing to wait and see. Alex called Jane as soon as she got off the subway and was walking to work. "So how was lunch?" She had been itching to call her for the past 2 hours and couldn't wait for Jane to call her. "It was great. He's such a nice guy." I told him about John, and he understood.
"Why did you do that?"
Alex was instantly annoyed. Clearly, Jane was not destined to be a femme fatale.
"I had to. He asked me to dinner. I told him I couldn't. But he suggested we go to a movie sometime, and he has a boat. He invited me to go out on it with him this spring."
She was happy at the prospect, and it all sounded hopeful to Alex. She was pleased for her friend.
"That's perfect. Don't write him off yet. You never know what will happen with John, and this one sounds like a good man."
"He is. His mother is an artist, his father was a professor, and he's very knowledgeable about art. I might go to the Christie's sale with him."
"He seems interested in seeing you again. Today was a perfect first move."
Alex was treating it like a chess game or a battle plan to catch him, which wasn't Jane's style either. She had never done anything premeditated or conniving to catch a man. Things either happened or they didn't, and Philip seemed that way too. Alex liked to give destiny a hand to get what she wanted, which didn't always work for her. Some men figured it out and ran like hell, and the ones who fell into her well-laid traps often turned out to be stupid and bored her. When Jane got back to work, she had a stack of messages on her desk of people she had to call, and two new folders of cases that had been referred to the court, all small estates. She didn't see Harriet till 4 o'clock when she brought one of the completed folders back to her, after determining that the person listed was in fact deceased, just as she had done with Marguerite in the beginning. She handed the file to Harriet across her desk, and Harriet thanked her. She appeared tired and discouraged, and Jane almost felt sorry for her.
"Everything okay?" she asked hesitantly.
Harriet looked as though she might have been crying, which was unusual for her. There was a vulnerability to her that Jane had never seen before, or even suspected.
"More or less. Thanks for asking," she said with tears shining in her eyes. "I had to admit my mom to the hospital last night. She has advanced MS, and she's getting worse. She was having trouble swallowing and breathing. I may have to put her in a nursing facility now, and she's going to hate it if that happens."
There was no way to reverse the disease, and Harriet had been caring for her at home for 7 years with the help of visiting nurses.
"We knew it would come to this sooner or later. She's just not ready to face it. and I'm not sure I am either. It's challenging, but I'd rather keep her at home with me.
I'm sorry, Jane said gently. She had always suspected that Harriet had a sad life, and she had heard that her mother was sick, but she didn't know it was as bad as this. And the genuine pain and sadness on the older woman's face tore at Jane's heart. Some people had such hard lives, and Harriet Fine was one of them, and her mother. She had given up her own life to take care of her invalid mother, and it was all she had now. It seemed too late for her to marry and have kids, and when her mother died, she would be all alone. It almost made Jane cry when she answered,
"Is there anything I can do?" "No, but you're kind to offer."
She didn't tell Jane how jealous she had been of her at first. She was young and free and alive, with a whole life and career ahead of her. For Harriet, it was more than half over, and everything she could see ahead of her was a dead end. But she had made her own choices, for better or worse, along the way. What one forgot while doing so, however good one's motives, was that you don't get the time back in the end. And one day, the game is over. Jane's youth and opportunities were what Harriet resented, although it wasn't Jane's fault. And she had come to like her in spite of it. Harriet thought she would make a good lawyer one day. Harriet had nothing bad to say about her, and had grown to like Jane, with her gentle, sunny ways.
"By the way," Jane remembered Philip's mother then, "the jewelry rep at Christie's asked if I could send him digital copies of all the photographs we have in the Pignelli case, from the safe deposit box. I think he wants to check them again for the catalog. Is it all right if I send them to him?"
It sounded as innocent as it was, and Harriet didn't need to know they were for his mother.
"Of course,"
Harriet answered, and didn't ask any questions. Jane went back to her office then, wrote a short email to Philip, thanking him for a delightful lunch, and told him she had gotten permission to send the images. She sent him all of them in a separate email a minute later, even the ones of the unidentified child, so the selection was complete. He saw the email come through, smiled as he read her short note, and printed the photographs for his mother, and another set for himself, just to have them if he wanted to refer to them again. He put both sets in confidential envelopes, and sent one set to his mother by messenger. Jane had made it easy to fulfill his mother's request, and then he went back to work. He had been in a good mood all afternoon after his lunch with Jane. It made him even sorrier that she had a boyfriend, but he was determined to see her again anyway, even in the guise of friendship. Jane thought about Philip, too, as she took the subway home that night. She was hoping to see John, since he had sent her a text that he'd be back from the library early. She didn't feel guilty about Philip, since she'd been honest with him, and she had decided to follow Alex's advice and not say anything about it to John. Things were tense enough between them at the moment, without adding fuel to the fire. She was pleased that John was home when she walked into the apartment. He was sprawled out on the couch, with papers all around him, his computer on the table, and he was reading something. He seemed happy to see her, and she leaned over to kiss him as he lay there.
"What a pleasure that you're here for a change," she said sincerely. "What's that supposed to mean?"
he asked, instantly irritated. He had dark circles under his eyes, as he'd had for months. Learning to become a successful entrepreneur wasn't easy, and seemed a lot harder to her than becoming a lawyer.
"It means I'm happy you're home," she said simply.
His temper was always short these days. He was sleep-deprived, and he obviously felt guilty for the time he wasn't spending with her.
"Should I make something for dinner?" she offered. "Have you eaten?"
"I don't have time. We're meeting at Kara's in an hour. I have to get going."
He got up off the couch, and Jane looked disappointed, and it didn't go unnoticed that Kara seemed to have become house mother to the group.
"Are you going to the Hamptons this weekend?"
Jane asked as she sat down on the couch where he'd been lying. She looked worried as she asked him, wondering if it was going to be another lonely weekend. The Hamptons were deserted in winter. They walked on the beach when they took breaks, even when there was snow on the ground. The walks were healthy and invigorating, and John said the air cleared their heads. And they all pitched in doing the cooking, and none of them brought their significant others, so Jane had never been invited.
"I need to," he said to justify it. "I think I'm going to be out there every weekend now till June."
He looked almost belligerent as he said it, which was pure guilt. He was ready for a fight,
But she wouldn't give it to him. She tried to be understanding and not rock the boat unduly. They were on very thin ice these days.
"How do people manage to graduate who don't have a house in the Hamptons?" she asked him in a more acerbic tone than she usually used when they discussed it. But hearing that he was going to be at Kara's with the others every weekend for the next 4 months was not good news to her. It wasn't even about jealousy now, although some of it was. It was about respecting their relationship and trying to maintain it through this dry spell, and he really wasn't trying. He was doing whatever worked for him and forgetting about her. It was tough to live with.
"You don't need to be a bitch about it, Jane."
His comment was particularly unfair since she hadn't been and had made a real effort not to press him about it or complain.
"I'm not, but you're gone all the time. How many nights do you think you've slept here in the last month? 10? 5? And now you're gone every weekend. What am I supposed to think about us?"
"You're supposed to think that that's the deal if you live with a guy getting an MBA in 4 months,"
he said in a nasty tone.
"I have a hard time believing that the other MBA candidates are sleeping with their study groups and spending every weekend in the Hamptons. Some people even manage to maintain relationships and marriages."
She paused for a moment then, and suddenly decided to confront him.
"Are you sleeping with Kara, John? Maybe we should just be honest with each other. Is it over with us? If it is, I'll move out."
"Is that what you want? You want out?"
he said, moving his face close to hers. It didn't frighten her, or even intimidate her. It just broke her heart. She could hear sucking sounds as she watched their relationship slide down the drain like an aspic. He was no longer the kind, funny, easygoing man she had fallen in love with 3 years before and loved to be with. He was a stranger, with or without an MBA.
"I don't want out, but I want you in this relationship with me if you still want it. I'm here all by myself."
And he hadn't answered her question. And maybe because she'd had lunch with another man that day and had had a nice time and been treated well, she decided to press it.
"What about Kara?"
Her eyes never left his, and then he turned and walked away.
"What about her?"
he said angrily.
"Are you having an affair with her?"
"Of course not,"
he said, but it didn't sound convincing.
"I don't have time to sleep with her or anyone else."
"You have the opportunity. You spend a lot more time with her than you do with me now."
"I spend more time with Jake, Bob, and Tom, too, and I'm not fucking them either. Or are you accusing me of that, too?"
He tried to make her seem ridiculous for worrying about Kara, but that only made him seem more guilty. And she had serious concerns about their relationship and the amount of time he was spending with Kara and not with her.
"Look, this is the deal now. You know how hard I've been working."
He tried to speak to her more calmly, but barely succeeded.
"If you can hold out till June without going crazy and driving me nuts with jealous bullshit, we can make it. If you're going to bust my chops about it all the time, I can't take it. So figure out what you want to do. You need to keep yourself busy until I'm done. Until then, I have no time to give you, and I don't want to hear about it every time I see you."
Listening to him, she wondered if she should move out. He had absolutely no interest in her needs or feelings, only his own. It was what Alex had never liked about him. Even at his best, she had thought he was a totally selfish guy, and he was proving her right. Jane didn't say a word to him as he strode around the apartment gathering things up to put in his backpack and computer bag. She saw a clean sweatshirt, socks, and underwear go into the backpack and knew it meant he wasn't coming home.
"I take it you're staying out tonight?" she said tersely.
"You're not my mother, Jane. I'll come home when I want to and when I can."
She didn't know exactly when it had happened, but he had clearly lost respect for her, completely. She didn't answer him. She didn't want to dignify his insults with a response or lose her temper at him. She had to come to her own conclusions, and she was beginning to realize what they were. She knew in her heart of hearts that this would never be a healthy relationship again. He didn't say goodbye when he left the apartment, nor did she. She was too ashamed to call Alex and tell her what had happened or what he had said to her. She just sat on the couch, thinking about it, her heart aching, and burst into tears. No matter how long it took her to deal with it, it was over, and she knew it. Now it was a matter of self-respect, Whatever he had been in the beginning, he no longer was, and all he could see in his future was Kara, not her. It was time to move on.
Chapter 9. When Valerie got the copies of the photographs that Philip had printed out for her, she spread them on her dining room table carefully and stared at them intently. She thought there was a faint family resemblance somewhere around Marguerite's eyes, although she wasn't sure to whom. Maybe to her mother, or to herself, but it was so faint that it could have been her imagination, or something she wanted to see that wasn't there. And she was struck in several photographs by the poignant expression in Marguerite's eyes, despite the wide smile. She was haunted by the images of her with Umberto, and the tangible love that jumped from the pictures, and that they obviously shared. He looked as though he adored her, and she seemed happy with him. Marguerite was so young in the early photographs that it touched Valerie's heart. But she couldn't honestly say that she was certain they were related. Marguerite had a very different look and style, and was very much herself. She had a very distinctive appearance, and was a beautiful girl. And although Valerie didn't resemble Winnie and her parents, she didn't bear a strong similarity to Marguerite either. There was no reason to think that they shared anything more than a fairly common name. Valerie herself didn't know why she was so intent on establishing a bond between them. It wasn't about the jewelry. It was something more. It was about history and blood, if that proved to be the case. She felt closer to the woman than ever after staring at her photographs for 2 days, and finally, late the second night, she spread out the pictures of the unknown child. She looked like a sweet little girl, and the photographs documented her 2 or 3 times a year. At first she was only a baby, then a toddler, and a little girl. But it was a photograph of the child at around the age of 5 that nearly stopped Valerie's heart. She picked it up and stared at it, looked at it under a bright light, and stared into the little girl's eyes. She'd had dresses like that as a child, and worn the same haircut. So had half the children she knew at the time. But it was the face that was familiar to her, and the eyes. She was certain of it. She sat for hours looking at it, went away, and came back to it. She examined all the pictures more closely, and in 2 or 3 she was almost sure, not totally certain, because most of them were from a little distance, and they weren't in perfect focus, but she grew more mesmerized by them by the hour. She looked at them in daylight the next day, gathered them up and put them in her purse, and called Winnie, who was finally recovering from her cold.
"Can I come over?"
"You'll have to come this morning," Winnie said tersely. "I'm playing bridge at noon."
"I won't stay long."
Valerie hailed a cab in front of her building, and was at Winnie's apartment in 20 minutes, which was record time from downtown. Winnie was still eating breakfast when she arrived, with all her pills lined up in front of her. And she nearly groaned when she saw Valerie's face. She could see that she was on another crusade.
"What now?"
she asked, sipping her coffee, while the maid asked Valerie if she'd like tea. Valerie smiled at her and declined, and focused on Winnie, and then took the photographs out of her bag and held them in her hand. It was almost as though she could feel a connection to the little girl through the images on the paper.
"I don't know if Marguerite de Saint-Pignelli was any relation to us, and she probably wasn't, and I have no idea who this child was in relation to her, but I am absolutely certain," she said as she handed the pictures to her sister, "that that child is me. I have no clue as to why there would be photographs of me in that safe deposit box, but Winnie, look at her! It's me!"
Valerie appeared thunderstruck as she said it, and had been since the night before. Her sister was unimpressed. She glanced at the photographs and shrugged.
"All children look alike," she said, not willing to agree.
"That's a ridiculous thing to say. We don't have any photographs of our sister, thanks to our parents throwing them all away. God knows why."
"Because they made our mother sad,"
Winnie said fiercely, defending them again.
"We have none of her at any age, so we don't know what she looked like. But we have a few of me. You can't deny it. This child looks just like me as a little girl. I even had a dress like that."
"So did every child I knew. In those days, everyone dressed their children alike. We all had the same haircuts, either bowl cuts or braids. We all wore little smocked dresses. I can't even tell you from me in half the photographs we have, and we look nothing alike.
No, we don't.
Valerie agreed with her.
But I look just like this child.
Valerie was dogged about it.
So you should get the money and jewels because you think you look like this child? She probably wasn't even related to Marguerite, the one who owned the jewels, not our sister.
So why did she keep photographs of her in her safe deposit box and hang on to them for more than 70 years?
Why are you driving yourself crazy? This has been settled. It's all about the money for you, isn't it? You're possessed,
Winnie said, distressed again. Valerie was disturbing her peace of mind. Winnie liked an orderly life, with all the loose ends tied up, and they always had been. And now Valerie was trying to make a mess of everyone's life, past and present.
It has nothing to do with the money, Valerie insisted, took a breath, and tried to explain.
Winnie, all my life I felt like an outcast in my own family, a stranger among all of you. You and Mother looked alike and got along. Father protected both of you. I was the ugly duckling, the strange one, the one who was always different, who never looked or thought like any of you. I never, ever fit in, and they hated me for it. All I want now is to find out who I am, who I was, and why I didn't fit. I think the answer is here, somewhere in these photographs, and I don't know why, but I think this woman knew. Maybe she wasn't our older sister, or maybe she was. Maybe she was an outcast, too. They wiped our Marguerite off the slate of our lives, as though she didn't exist. She disappeared out of our family history, and they would have done the same to me if they could. And now I want to know why. If she was our sister, what did she do? What happened to her? And was I too much like her? Was it acceptable in our family only to be carbon copies of them? Was it a crime to be different, punishable by death or banishment? They didn't mourn her. They erased her completely. Why? They didn't kill our sister, Winnie said with a furious look. Or banish her. She died, and they never did anything to you.
Except hate me, and ignore me, and treat me like I didn't belong to them, and should never have happened. Did they do that to her, too?
Let her rest in peace,
Winnie said desperately. She didn't know the answers either, but she didn't want to. Valerie did. She was starving for answers she had waited all her life to hear, and refused to be silenced again.
I can't let her go,
Valerie said miserably.
And I don't know why, but the child has the answers. I know she does. I can feel it in my bones. And I want to know those answers now, too, about why they never loved me, and I never fit in. Look how different we are. We're sisters, and we're night and day. If the woman in the photographs was our sister, maybe she and I were more alike.
You're trying to exhume an ally, Winnie said angrily, who's been dead for 73 years. You have to make your own peace with who you are and why you never fit.
I can't. I don't know why, but I just can't,
Valerie said as tears slid down her face. For years, as an adult, Valerie had accepted the fact that her parents didn't love her and had a good life anyway. She'd had a great marriage and loved her husband and son, but now something jarring had happened, and she needed to know what it was. It had brought back all the unhappy memories of her childhood and her parents' constant rejection of her and either inability or refusal to love her. And she had to know why and if the answers were somehow linked to the photographs she believed were of her as a child. She felt she had a right to know.
You won't find the answers here,
Winnie said coldly,
or by maligning our parents or by turning our sister into someone she never was. The woman who married the Italian Count was no relation to us, no matter how badly you want her money. Valerie, this is all about greed. And that child in the photographs looks like any other child at the time, not just you.
No,
Valerie said, her eyes blazing.
She's me. I know it. No matter how you want to deny it, Winnie, that child is me, and I want to know why.
A dead woman won't tell you, no matter how rich she was. If any of what you say is true, and I don't believe it, she took her secret to the grave, and she wasn't our sister,
Winnie said in a tone of fury.
Our sister died 73 years ago, she repeated. Let her be!
Winnie said and stood up, glaring at her sister.
I have better things to do than listen to this insanity. I think you're losing your mind. I would worry about that if I were you.
What she said was like a slap across Valerie's face, and she left a few minutes after a terse goodbye between the two sisters. Winnie's hands were shaking when she got dressed to go out for her bridge game. And when Valerie got back to her apartment, she sat down and cried, and then stared at the photographs of the little girl again. But however adamantly Winnie was denying it, Valerie knew she was right, that it was her. And then she remembered something she had gotten a year before, and had almost forgotten since. She went looking for it in some of her files and couldn't find it.